advised the Court of Appeals Division 1 is now in session.
Please be seated. Good morning. We're here today for oral argument in the matter of Head v. City of Mesa, our case number 1CA-CV24-0842. I think all the litigants here are familiar with the processes or the procedure, but you have 20 minutes per side. Appellant, you have the right to reserve any time for rebuttal, but you have to keep track of it yourself. Though sometimes I'm nice and we'll say, hey, you've only got 3 minutes left. We will be recording this and posting it on YouTube and live streaming it for the three people that have no lives that will sit and watch. Keep that in mind. So please, when you get up, announce who you are and who you represent. And I think that's all. Is there anything I'm forgetting?
The body cam.
Oh, well, yes. One thing before you begin, counsel. Both sides referenced some body cam footage, and in our scouring of our record, we've been unable to locate that body cam footage. So tell us what that means and what, if anything, we need to do. All right, Mr. Abney.
Yes, ma'am.
May it please the court, my name is David Abney. I'm here with Scott Halverson, my co-counsel, and representing the plaintiff appellant. As far as the body camera footage, I think it would basically reiterate what the written presentations have been. I don't think there's any surprise there, but perhaps my colleague across the aisle has the technological savvy to make sure that that gets to the court for its review.
And I don't speak for the panel, just myself, since there doesn't really seem to be a dispute that there was on the facts that would be disclosed in the body cam. I don't know that it's necessary for us. I mean, is there a factual dispute that we need to resolve via the body cam? And I'm not sure what our standard review would be with that regard anyway.
No, it's more what do you do with the law taking the facts as we have described them already into account?
So not to put you on the spot, but is you think we can decide this case based upon the record that's before us, which doesn't at this point include the body cam?
I believe so, Your Honor. If you decide it in my favor, I guarantee it. But if not, I'll be cursing in private.
Thank you, Mr.
I did file last night, and I apologize for this. I had one of my rare victories at the Supreme Court, Roebuck versus Mayo Clinic, and which upheld.
Who was on the panel on the Court of Appeals that gave you your initial victory on that one?
I don't have that with me.
It might have been Judge Morris was one of the judges.
Yeah, I could have been, yes. A distinguished jurist in any event. But, I mean, they substituted some of their reasoning, but the end result was the same. But somebody at the State Bar contacted the plaintiff's lawyer, and who contacted me, and said they wanted a little bit of an explanation of some of the ramifications of the thing. So I was working on that last night because they wanted it right away. And I was up around 11 o'clock, and I kept looking at this thing at 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock. And so I'm trying to say what ramifications are. I mean, what do I know, right? So, but then I kept reading the gross negligence discussion in the opinion, which is very long, very detailed, and incredibly helpful. And I filed the supplemental citation to legal authorities. I gave three copies to the clerk. I don't know if they made it to your desk or not.
Not yet.
Perhaps they might at some point. But the point of Roebuck was they had a discussion finally to tell us what gross negligence means. And the courts have been dancing around this for years. The Court of Appeals has been doing it, and the Supreme Court has been doing it. You get definitions of gross negligence as negligence that is gross. I mean, you go in a circle. Or you get definitions of saying, well, gross negligence is something that's in the air, and you just know it when you see it, sort of thing, which is very unhelpful. But the Supreme Court in the Roebuck case, paragraphs 18 and 19, has finally explained, you take regular negligence, and then you add the crucial ingredient, which is reckless indifference. And the quote of paragraph 18, gross negligence, however, requires an additional showing that the defendant acted with reckless indifference, and then paragraph 19, to reiterate, in sum, gross negligence adds a quasi-intent element requiring showing the defendant acted with reckless indifference. So now, finally, plaintiffs and, for that matter, defendants can go into court and say, this is what gross negligence is. We don't have this weird definitions that we had before. Like in the days before punitive damages finally settled down and we got, you know, conscious indifference, deliberate, conscious disregard, deliberate indifference, we got some sort of idea. Before that, punitive damages was all over the board, all kind of adjectives to try to describe it. But now we've got a little bit something to deal with. And it matters in this case a great deal. And perhaps a remedy this court might consider would be a remand for the trial court to take another look at the gross negligence elements of what happened in light of this new standard. I hate to drag out the process, but that might be the right, a good thing to do.
Mr. Abney, what would you say, because I read Robeck and was interested in it, and I agree it maybe says stuff more clearly, but I didn't recall that it changed anything as far as the definition of gross negligence. So where would you feel is your strongest argument that Robeck said something that wasn't already said maybe in three different cases beforehand?
Oh, and in the paragraph 18 and 19, and there's some preliminary discussion leading up to that. Never before has a court simply said, this is it. It's the element that you need on top of regular negligence is reckless indifference. There have been so many different definitions, and I used a whole bunch in the opening brief and in the reply brief. And what this turned into for decades was a contest. I and lawyers in my position would say, oh, gross negligence is really just a walk in the park. There's nothing really too hard about it. It's just this little bit extra that you need. And then the other side would make it sound like you're climbing Mount Everest without oxygen, that you can never, hardly ever get gross negligence. It's such an extremely hard standard to prove. And now it's not that hard a standard. As for the facts in this case, where it matters, first of all, is for battery. The judge wiped out the battery claim by saying, well, I agree there's a battery, and surely there is. I mean, it's a touching that you wouldn't consent to a dog chewing your leg or to being tasered and all these other things. That's a battery, no question. But then it said, well, I'm going to say there's qualified immunity because there was no gross negligence. But what these police officers did could readily be construed by the trier of fact as being really uncaring to what happened to this man and what they did in releasing the dog when there were still negotiations going on and in tasering him and, you know, applying this extreme level of force is really an example of recklessness. And so you have it there.
So, Mr. Abney, here's what I am trying to understand in your argument. I mean, you mention deadly physical force, but then you don't really argue that too much. You mention, you know, you argue about the qualified immunity and you argue about negligence and gross negligence. Can you, like, for us today, just explain what are the issues as you see them in this case that you're asking us to decide?
Okay, the first one is battery. We can take it as a given there was a battery. Are these police officers exonerated because they have qualified immunity?
So isn't the issue qualified immunity, not battery then?
Well, the qualified immunity wipes out the battery.
But it wipes out negligence
too,
doesn't it?
It wipes out liability for the battery. So if you do have that qualified immunity, which the trial court was very clear saying it's, you know, you have qualified immunity because you were not grossly negligent. And that's where Robeck comes into play.
So if we decide that qualified immunity does apply here, the only other question then is whether there's gross negligence.
To decide qualified immunity, though, you need to deal with the trial judge's evaluation of the situation that there was no gross negligence.
Understood.
And if you do that, if you do that under the reckless indifference standard, you'd be in a quandary because this really is a heavily fact-intensive question.
But I guess what I'm saying is you're asking us to remand on the gross negligence piece, but we only get there if we don't find qualified immunity, if we don't hold that the qualified immunity judgment stands.
Yes, and I believe that you can only find qualified immunity here if you determine that there was no gross negligence.
You see what I'm getting at? Like, it feels like a chicken or an egg issue.
I know.
So that's what I'm trying to nail down is what exactly do we need to decide in this case, and what are you asking us to decide?
Is there a genuine dispute of material fact on gross negligence?
Okay.
And in order to determine that, you really should be applying the latest law on the subject. You know, and, of course, the Superior Court did not have the benefit of the clarity that Roebuck has brought to us on that particular point.
Counsel?
Yes, ma'am.
So I read my understanding is that in order to overcome qualified immunity, you have to show the officers knew or should have known that they were violating clearly established law or had a reckless disregard of whether they were violating established law. Is that right?
Yeah, you're using reckless disregard for gross negligence. Absolutely. That would be it. Or. It's an or sort of thing.
So what are the facts you think that show that? What is your argument? Why was this a violation of clearly established law that they knew or should have known or had reckless disregard of?
All right. And that's setting aside for the moment the gross negligence thing.
Well, I don't really read gross negligence so much as part of the standard that I see. I think reckless disregard was already established in one of the Court of Appeals decisions interpreting qualified immunity. And so for me, it is reckless disregard. But I just don't see I don't quite understand what your argument is why there's this established law that they recklessly disregarded.
The established law is you do not get to use non-trivial force against a suspect unless there is an immediate threat to himself or to others. And there were a number of factors here that reasonable jurors could say, well, hold on, there really was no immediate threat at the time you released the dog and at the time you tasered him over and over. For instance, at that time...
Not to put you on the spot, but generally when they say well-established law, there's a case that you cite to support that says pretty much that directly on point. So what would be the case that would say that?
I put a whole bunch. Let me glance through my. Okay, Glenn versus Washington County.
Glenn
GLENN versus Washington County, and Smith versus City of Hemet, HEMET, and then I cited a number of other cases in there as well.
Are any of those cases Arizona cases?
Those are Ninth Circuit cases, but they're describing general law.
But from the Ninth Circuit, aren't they looking at 1983 claims?
They arose in the context of 1983 claims, but their explication of what would qualify here as a situation where you can use excessive force has been applied in Arizona before, and of course Arizona cases follow the same sort of logic. You've got to show that there's an immediate threat of harm to himself or to others. And if that's not there, slow down, stop, don't attack, don't use excessive force. Now, I didn't use deadly force for a good reason, because there's a bunch of cases that say, God knows why, that tasers are not deadly force, even though they've killed people, and that dogs are not necessarily excessive force, even though they've caused grievous harm. I don't understand that, so I stayed away from deadly force, and I used extreme force or, you know,
non-trivial force.
Non-trivial force is a good word for it. And I'm sorry to dance around the subject, but I felt like I had to, and now my dance is over, and I have to deal with it directly. But for a battery, for the battery cause, the gross negligence is the defense to the battery. It's a qualified immunity. Then you get into our more esoteric theory, Ryan versus Napier type of situation. Can you say that there is a negligence cause of action for failing to defuse the situation, for failing to take actions that would have stopped any need at all to ever use any sort of force against this particular man?
What's a clearly established law that says you have to de-escalate?
No, not that I know of, although Garcia,
so
I think...
Aren't we in a qualified immunity situation there?
Well, yeah, but then you go back to excessive force. Right. If you start wandering to qualified immunity.
I thought you were making two different arguments. I thought you were arguing one was the excessive force and two,
yes,
de-escalate.
I'm trying to shift gears to get into the Ryan versus Napier situation. The battery, I think, is fairly clear. There was a battery, and the way you avoid liability for the battery is if there was gross negligence.
How long did this whole thing, didn't this go on for an hour?
It went on for an extended period of time, yeah. And in different phases.
De-escalating?
Yes, it was de-escalating. He had gotten rid of his weapon, according to his testimony, which has to be believed. He had unloaded it, gotten rid of it. He was nowhere near it.
And nowhere near it?
Nowhere near it. Well, according to him, it was out of his reach. He was not near it in that sense that he could grab it right away.
He also testified he had no recollection of the events, right?
Oh, no, he had a recollection that he had, and he testified.
Right. Not that he had no recollection, but he was in a blackout phase stage and thought that he had surrendered.
He was not doing well in any sense, okay. But he did say that he had tossed the weapon away and was unloaded. And he wasn't near it, from his perspective. And that he was...
Is there a dispute about how far the weapon was away from him?
Yeah, I love disputes because juries get to decide them. There are a whole bunch of disputes.
Well, here. I mean, I'm just wondering, how far away from him does appellant say it was? The gun was away from him.
It was out of his reach. It's my recollection, it was out of his reach. But yeah, there are disputes. There's a whole bunch of disputes. There's a dispute about whether he was mentally disturbed, whether he was passively resisting, whether he was suicidal, not suicidal, whether he was a threat to the public, whether he was a threat to the police officers. There are all kinds of things. And of course, we had our police practices expert adding his two cents in by saying there's no need for physical force under these circumstances, that the police officer in charge was giving unreasonable instructions to the police to release the dog too early. Our expert said there was no need to rush, no need to use force, the use of multiple force, a whole bunch of people attacking at the same time.
Does your expert say anything about whether the officer should have known it violated well-established law?
Well, I already discussed earlier the use of force against somebody who poses no threat, immediate threat to himself or to others.
Okay.
You don't need to attack at that time. They were negotiating with him and making some progress. There again, was it enough progress? Should they have delayed longer? Should they have done different tactics? Those are jury questions. Those are all questions of fact and highly disputed in this particular case.
I was just going to ask, what exact act are you saying caused the gross negligence, battery? I mean, obviously the touching with the tasering and the dog is the battery piece, but where are you saying that gross negligence occurred? Is it the decision to deploy the dog? Is it
no.
After, can you explain that to me?
Well, the negligence and gross negligence, the gross negligence, we're talking about the Ryan versus Napier part, where I'm trying to wedge off negligence away from intentional conduct. In that regard, it was failing to let the process go forward to try to negotiate an end to this situation without having to attack him.
So that's a discretionary sort of act that you're challenging. Is that correct?
To some extent. But then again, you know, it's all this.
What's not discretionary about it?
Well, it depends exactly what the facts are, and only the trier of fact can really determine what are the facts, what was actually going on at the time that the police officers just lost their patience and said, "This is enough," and go ahead and attack them. I think there's a critical point here that the trier of fact has to determine where in the continuum is there a break here where we can say, okay, things should have continued forward.
I think the trier of fact is the one maybe that would make that determination, but
right.
You have to allege that. You have to allege what exactly that point in time is, what that discretionary decision is that you're pointing to.
Oh, the discretionary decision was to attack when there was no need to attack. And if they had simply followed what our police expert says they should have been doing, or what common sense to the jury may say they should have been doing, which is try to defuse the situation without attacking this man, then there would have never been an attack at all.
Are you conflating the policies or best practices with clearly established law?
No.
Because, I mean, in your brief, you rely a lot upon the policy regarding dog deployment, but I don't know that that establishes law that a jury could find was violated.
It's standard of care. And that's why the police practice expert matters a great deal in this particular case. What's the standard of care for a situation like this? Do you simply give up and say, "To heck with it, release
but
the dogs"?
Not,
or
but you don't to overcome qualified immunity. You don't showing a violation of a standard of care or negligence is not enough. It is you have to show a violation of clearly established law
or gross negligence.
Or gross negligence.
And reckless indifference is now we know the key to gross negligence, the credo explaining it.
I think we knew that before, but I'll look at your supplemental to see.
Well, and I think you'll find it, if not instructive, at least entertaining. We were all dancing around this before, the standards that even in these briefs that we gave, and we both worked very hard on these briefs, to talk about what gross negligence is. We're all over the block. And now no longer over the block, we have a robot.
You have
block.
A minute 40.
I have one question. I'm sorry. A factual question. So at some point in this negotiation, one of the officers said he's ready to surrender.
Right.
And then at some point later, the dog is sent in. How much was it right then, or was there did time pass between?
I think a minute or two, a couple minutes.
Okay.
Not a long period of time.
Okay.
I'll reserve my time.
All right. We'll give you a minute 15. Give him 2 seconds back there.
You're very generous, Your Honor. Thank you.
If this was basketball, I'd be thrilled.
New clerks, let's see if they can add 2 seconds to the time. If not, we'll count. I'll go like this, 1, 2, when you come back up, and then we'll start.
So regarding the question about the body cam footage, both sides, we had to file motions for leave to file electronic exhibits, and those motions were granted. Defendants' exhibits, non-electronic exhibits, were filed at IR 43.
So I'm just going to interrupt. We saw all of that in the record. The actual CDs or whatever you provided are not in the record. We called the court. So that's why we're asking you about it, because, you know, our question was, do we actually need it to resolve this? Because it's not there. If you think we need it, then we need you to submit it, because the Superior Court does not have it.
It's interesting. I don't know if they returned it. I mean, the court had clearly watched them when we had the oral argument, and so the judge was definitely aware of the body camera.
That's
footage.
Why we bring it up.
I will submit it, the defendant's exhibits on CDs, and send it to you. I do think it would be helpful. It's not that it's dependent. I mean, I guess if the plaintiff, I would say the plaintiff is not disputing almost all the facts that the defendant put in. But I do think it is helpful for you to see distance and size and how tiny that dumpster enclosure is, and so how they were working in these very confined spaces. A couple of factual things. There was the negotiator that said, I think he's going to stand up and I don't think she used the word surrender. 9 minutes passed. And in that 9 minutes, the plaintiff yelled profanities, get the F out of here, go away. There was no, and the officer client repeatedly said, the steps of surrender, stand up, face away from me, put your hands on your head, walk back to me, over and over and over again. He did none of those things. So it was 9 minutes. The other question about how far was the gun, yes, the plaintiff he's made a thing about he threw it away. If you watch the video, when you go in there, and Officer McClure, who was the canine handler, testified to this, when he's straddling the dog to remove the dog, you see him kick the gun away with his left foot. He kicks it out of the dumpster because it was dangerous having a loose gun in this very tiny space. So it's right at his feet is the point. Again, I also think the plaintiff's statement about, well, we have to believe the plaintiff's testimony. I think that's why the body camera footage is important. Because, yeah, the plaintiff testified to all sorts of things. But we submitted probably 6 or 7 body camera footage. They submitted another 3. There's a lot of body camera footage of this event. And it just completely refutes what the plaintiff is saying he did. So he can testify based on what he remembers in his drunken state, but it's all on video, and so we all know what happened. So I think the body camera footage is helpful in that regard.
Does that answer the question whether there's a disputed fact? I mean,
there's no disputed facts. I don't think there's any disputed facts. When I submitted our reply into the summary judgment motion, I noted that the plaintiff really didn't controvert any of the defendant's facts in this case. Another thing that I think is important is the plaintiff's...
Let me push back. If he testified the gun was out of my reach, and body camera footage shows the gun was within, I'm making up a number, 3.5 feet from his feet,
is that a disputed fact?
No, under Scott versus Harris, the basically says you do not have to, that's a U.S. Supreme Court case, but basically says when you have actual video evidence of what happened, the plaintiff cannot come in and basically.
That's the 1983 car chase case?
Correct.
Yes.
Correct. And basically what's on video. And again, he also testified that he was essentially in a blackout, drunk condition. He doesn't even remember how he got to the intersection, which means he actually drove a mile on city streets completely blacked out. There's a lot of things that he says he did that are totally refuted by the physical evidence, but that's here to there. I do want to point out, though, that the plaintiff's expert, the only admissible evidence in this record is the defendant's Exhibit H, which are the excerpts of her deposition that I put in the record. The defendant, the plaintiffs in this case, they then they submitted their exhibits 4, 5, and 6, which are expert reports. One of them is not even signed. We don't even know who wrote it. And the other two have her signature. I moved to strike those or exclude them, objected based on the evidence, saying those were hearsay, inadmissible hearsay. The court never ruled on it, but the court also didn't cite that expert's depo in its ruling. Obviously, this court can only decide that. That's actually a pretty big issue that was in my answering brief. That's briefed at page 29 and 30. This court can only decide summary judgment based on evidence that would be admissible at trial. An expert's report is not admissible evidence. They could have done a declaration. They could have done their own portions of her deposition, but they didn't. So the only admissible evidence of that expert's opinions is Defendant's Exhibit H.
How much do those expert reports even matter for our analysis?
Well, I don't think they do matter at all. Well, I mean, certainly she goes to all sorts of lengths and she makes all sorts of opinions. I think what's interesting about her opinions is what I want to call tactical negligence. There's two claims in this case. There's the battery claim, which is count one, and then they have this negligence claim, and that's the Ryan versus Napier, and that's count two. And the plaintiffs have tried to shoehorn these cases into the Ryan versus Napier, and they're trying to say, okay, well, I get the actual deployment of the dog and the deployment of the taser, that's a battery, but everything that happened before that, I get to have a cause of action to get that for negligence, or in this case, the plaintiff during summary judgment briefing said, you know what, I'm not going to do negligence, I'll just say gross negligence. I don't know why he did that, but they did, as if they
Counsel,
think that's going to save
a question?
The case.
I didn't understand this from the brief, so I got a little confused during mm-hmm. Mr. Abney's oral argument, but does the qualified immunity apply to the gross negligence claim or just the intentional battery?
In this case, the city, we moved, raised the qualified immunity defense in response to count one, battery, because that's the only cognizable claim. As to count two, it is not a cognizable claim. Therefore, we didn't raise, quote, defenses to it because it's not a cognizable claim. That's the point. Whether it would be, I don't know, but you'd have to first decide it's even a cognizable claim, and it's not. Ryan versus Napier basically said, it said, what's the line? How is a battery different than negligence? And it's in paragraph 20 of that opinion. It says, when the defendant acts with intent to cause a harmful touching, the same act cannot constitute negligence. And then they go into a very large analysis of even looking at other cases where they said, well, what about the officer's internal evaluation about thinking about should I deploy use force, and then deciding to do it. And the court at paragraphs 22 and 23 said, no, that's not cognizable. And they went through all of those factors. And again, the plaintiffs have been trying for a while to get these, like I call the tactical negligence theories out there, saying, well, if you had waited longer, if you'd called for more backup, if you had sent him, you know, gifts, whatever. they have all sorts of things, and they can find an expert who's going to come in and say, and pick apart all the tactics that the police used before they actually used force. And Ryan versus Napier says that is not a cognizable claim. In that case, that actually, Ryan versus Napier involved a canine deployment. And in that case, it actually involved this very long period of time where they're chasing the guy, and then he gets out, and then he gets back into his car. The officers are giving him commands. He's not complying. And the canine officer releases the dog, saying he's not compliant. Turns out the man was having a severe hypoglycemic event. He had diabetes, and he did not have the cognitive function to be able to understand what was going on or even comply. So that would be very easy to frame in negligence terms. You could say the sheriff's deputy negligently assessed the driver's behavior. He viewed him as defiant and noncompliant. He didn't follow his training when it says to how do you recognize people experiencing medical emergencies. He had a mistake of fact when he decided that the driver was acting in a criminal matter as opposed to that he was experiencing a medical emergency. And the Supreme Court said, no, it's a battery. You do not get to frame this in terms of negligence or gross negligence, however you want to say it. They go on to cite several different other cases. They cite the Lattice case in paragraph 22, and they cite the Britton case in paragraph 26. I can go through those facts. They're all interesting, but they all have this. Again, there's always an event that happens before. There's minutes. There's lots of things that are happening, and someone can come in and say there was negligent tactics. You should have positioned yourself outside of the sidewalk.
And in this case, you're arguing that's what he's doing by arguing the failure to de-escalate.
Absolutely. So essentially, the city's argument on count two is it is not a cognizable claim.
Your argument would be under Napier, the only claim that can be proceeded or covered is battery.
Is battery.
Battery is not it is cognizable.
It is a cognizable claim.
It is defeated by.
And the defendants have both a justification defense to that, right, and then the qualified immunity defense.
And the qualified immunity defense as to battery cannot be overcome if they show grossly negligent battery?
Well,
is that a non-cognizable claim, gross negligent battery?
Yeah, there's no such thing as a negligent battery. Ryan versus right. Napier says that is right. Clear.
Is there a grossly negligent battery?
Yeah, in the qualified immunity context, you're looking at whether the defendants acted with reckless disregard for the person's rights when they decided to make discretionary acts. And here, the discretionary act of the command was given to move in for the arrest at 1:58. Should it be 207, or should it have been 155? Those were discretionary tactical decisions that the lieutenant on scene made. For the primary purpose, and I get to his thing about the fact that he wasn't an immediate threat to the officers. And this goes into the justification defense. I do want to make clear, the city is claiming in this case that it is entitled to summary judgment under the justification statute 13409. The trial court did not go that way, but obviously you guys can affirm for any basis in the record. And so that is an additional reason, and that is not dependent on the application of the evidentiary presumption found in 12.716 paragraph A. He said there were disputes of fact on that evidentiary presumption. I don't think there are, but even if you just go with the justification defense, the defendants are entitled to summary judgment on that issue. And this is why I want to point that out. That statute, when it basically gives a police officers, they say they are justified in using non-deadly physical force and making an arrest. One of the elements is a person is justified in using physical force and making an arrest when a reasonable person would believe that such force is immediately necessary to effect the arrest. The justification defense is not focused on the timing of making the arrest.
But counsel, I'm going to push back a little bit there because it talks about a reasonable person. And so, I mean, I think that's what plaintiff's counsel is getting to, is that there could be an issue of fact there as to, you know, what a reasonable person would determine and what a reasonable person determined that it could have been 207 rather than 158. So I think that there is sort of a question there as to reasonable person and what would a reasonable person think.
I will disagree because the statute, again, the reasonableness is tied to whether the force was immediately necessary to effect the arrest.
But
it's not.
Couldn't there be a question as to, I mean, on this panel, we could disagree as to that particular thing. Was the force necessary to effect the arrest? We could have that dispute. So if we're going down that path, aren't we into a place where there is factual determinations that need to be made?
I don't think so. Again, I think when we get into the timing of when to make the arrest, which is what they really are disputing, that argument would make sense if the justification statute said a person is justified in using physical force in making an arrest when a reasonable person would believe making the arrest is immediately necessary. Like, we got to do it right now. That's what they're disputing. That's not what the justification statute says. It says police officers are going to go make that arrest. Is this force immediately necessary to make the arrest? And there's no dispute on that. There's none. Even their expert in the excerpts that are part of the record in Exhibit H says, well, when you approach, of course, police officers have to take all these precautions. They're basically approaching a person who hasn't been patted down. We know he has access to a gun. We don't know what is behind any of these things. Of course, you have to take all these precautions. You approach with a canine. You approach with a taser. I mean, their expert said that. And we actually provided the evidence in there about why the canine was used. There's the State versus Doss case. And yes, that's a criminal case, but in that case, the dog was deployed to a person who had barricaded himself in someone's backyard. No canine warnings were given. The guy was still able to grab his gun and shoot the dog and kill it. And his defense, one of the charges he was facing in that case was animal cruelty, and he was trying to rely on the 13404 justification, the self-defense justification. And in that case, the court said, no, regardless of whether the arrest is lawful or unlawful, the only question is whether you had reason to believe that this police officer was using force to effect your arrest. And I think that provision goes back to why the justification statute does not concern itself with the timing of the arrest. It concerns itself with the force used to effect the arrest, regardless of when the timing was, when it was done.
Understood. And here, I've got one more question that I want to ask about Ryan versus Napier.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it was a misstatement. That's why I'm going to ask you about it. I think you said just a moment ago that Ryan versus Napier, the holding applies to negligence and gross negligence, which is something that the Superior Court did find. They drew a tie based on Ryan from negligence to gross negligence, saying that basically because negligence is prohibited, so is gross negligence. You said something kind of along those same lines a few minutes ago. Can you elaborate on that a little bit? I just want to make sure I understand what your position is.
Well, the Ryan versus Napier case it talked about negligence law. And even in this Roebuck case that just came out, it says negligence and gross negligence are the same tort. It depends on the level of the breach of duty. That's really where the heightened standard comes in, because it would still be duty, breach, causation, damages. It's the same four elements. And the court in that case said, in Ryan versus Napier, said, those elements do not work in an intentional battery case, in an intentional use of force case. So they do not apply. I think the plaintiff is misreading Ryan to say, oh, well, if I allege gross negligence, I'm saved. I have an exception to Ryan. And the answer is no, you don't. It's still the same four elements. It's just on the breach of duty question that gross negligence is a heightened standard. But the Ryan court never carved out negligence or gross negligence claims from its analysis. It basically said, go to paragraph 20. It's either, was this an intentional act or not? If it's an intentional act, it's an intentional tort. You cannot mix intentional torts and negligence claims together. And so they did carve out this little, I don't know if it's an exception or just they left it open about there could be facts that show negligence. And the example they gave was the police officer drops the leash and the dog runs off and bites the guy. Well, that was negligence. He didn't intend to deploy him. It went off its own. There was another, in one of the cases that was cited, Brown versus, the Brown case, that the California case that the, Ryan actually cited and distinguished, that court actually did talk about, like, well, if the person, inadvertently fired, you know, it's the sympathetic reflex thing. They fired when they didn't mean to. Or they accidentally shot the wrong person. Maybe you could have a negligence claim in that circumstance. But even in the gross negligence context, you're still not talking about intentional conduct. And so that's why the that analysis just doesn't work in the Ryan versus Napier, in the gross negligence claim.
Counsel, I have one more question.
Sure.
Can you explain to me, going back, about what force was necessary to effectuate this arrest?
Mm-hmm.
Why was the second tasering necessary?
And that's where it would be helpful, I think, if you watch the body camera footage. At that point, the dog had been removed from the very tiny enclosure. And that's why I think it's important, because, you know, their complaint says the dog bite prolonged, the taser prolonged the dog bite. That's not true. The first taser was because when they walked in, and you hear them saying over and over again, show us your hands, show us your hands, show us your hands. And it was very clear that his left hand and arm are behind his back like this. And so the officer Juven tased Mr. Head for the purpose, and he explains in his deposition, it causes a 5-second muscular lockup. It doesn't cause injuries as much as they want to claim it does. In this case, he's actually alleged no injuries from these tasers. Then now the dog is removed. There, the two other officers had come in, and it's officers Walker and Galbraith, and they are repeatedly ordering the plaintiff, give us your hands, give us your hands, give us your hands. And so the plaintiff still was not surrendering his hands. He has them up here like this. That 23 seconds later, the officer Juven deployed the second taser. So as he testified in his deposition, I believe it's Exhibit D in the Statement of Facts, the whole purpose of the use of the taser is to essentially put the person on, they call it putting them under power for 5 seconds, so that other officers, it doesn't mean they're paralyzed, it doesn't mean they can't move, other officers can then grab their hands and put them behind their back. That's the point. This was such a tight space that's why the tasers were needed.
Thank you, Ms. Alvarado.
Thanks.
We are going to put 1 minute and 10 seconds onto appellant's time, because we went over a little bit.
Let's just start.
And the 2 more seconds that I gave him earlier, so that should take him to 2:25. All right.
I'm in the WNBA playoffs. Okay.
Are you Caitlin Clark?
Caitlin, yeah. Clark. I feel so sorry for her. I mean, she had a great season going, and everything falls apart. But they won last night. Am I using up my time? Oh, thank God.
Start
them. Start it. Okay. To answer your question earlier about the Ninth Circuit precedent, federal cases and whatnot, it really sort of goes back to the Arizona statute on justification. And the first point of that statute, which is 13-409-1, says that you're justified in using physical force to make an arrest if a reasonable person would believe the physical force was immediately necessary. So you've got to have an immediate need to use that physical force, and that's in our statute. That ties in with another statute, which is section 13-3881-B, that says that no unnecessary or unreasonable force shall be used in making an arrest. And then there's a bunch of case law construing this sort of situation, State versus Mincy. Do you want the citation or just the name? State versus Mincy says you have the right to use force in making arrest, but you cannot use excessive force. And in State versus Matthews, force is excessive if it goes beyond that which is immediately necessary to effect the arrest. And then you have another one there. A reasonable person have to believe that the arrest is both lawful and that the force used must seem immediately necessary. There's really fact questions there. Was it really necessary for them to use the force? And it all spins back to the strongest argument,
but
I think.
I think you're bypassing your opponent's argument, which is that it's once the decision to arrest was made, was the force necessary versus was the decision to arrest necessary at that point?
Well,
it seems to me, as I
hear you all read the statutes to us, that it's the, once the decision is made, that's where we measure the immediateness, not pre the decision being made.
Well, Ryan versus Napier, I would, and I've been trying to do this in federal and state courts with very little success, to try to break it off and say that, look, you've got this pre-use of force period where you can decide to do things right, and if you do them right, we never have use of force. And that has gone the way of the Titanic, mostly. But it's still a valid argument. I want to make it for the record hope for a miracle. But it's the, I think the big thing here, especially after Roebuck II, is this gross negligence thing. And I was reading through the briefs again as you were having a colloquy with my colleague across the aisle. May I finish my comment?
Just yes, briefly.
And I was listening to the comments in here, and it really goes back to the defense to the battery, which the trial judge said, I don't find gross negligence, and therefore, you're out.
Okay.
Thank you so much for the extra time.
Thank
I appreciate
you
it.
To all the litigants, and appreciate your presentation. We will take this matter under advisement. You know, I forgot to tell you at the beginning that we had conferenced the case and reviewed the briefs and record. That was what I left off, dang it. All right, now that we've done that, we will take this matter under advisement, and we will issue a written decision in due course. Thank you.